Good morning. How are you all this morning? Our text this morning is Luke chapter 10. Go ahead and turn there. And while you're turning to Luke chapter 10, I want you to listen to some real life 911 calls. I promise we didn't make these up. These are real life 911 calls. And what I want you to notice is there is a distinct disconnect that's happening. Listen to these.
911, what is your emergency?
This is a song, and you're going to like this. It ain't going to be long, okay?
Okay. You can't really dial 911 unless you have an emergency, okay?
I'm going to make this brief.
Okay.
Thank you for the media world. I thank God. God's music all over the world. Thank you. Thank you and you and you. Oh, you like it?
Yes, sir. That sounds good.
Okay, bye-bye.
911, what's emergency?
I need emergency, man. I'm about to turn into a werewolf, man. I need to
catch up this, bro. Is there anybody there with you?
My mama loves it. He's here with me.
Is there any way I can talk to him?
Yeah.
Sir, how you doing?
All right.
Does he have an emergency? He's saying that he's about to turn into a werewolf.
I don't know. I just woke up. I was in a landline.
Does he have any kind of medical problems?
Yeah, I've asked him.
He has asthma?
Yes, ma'am.
Can you ask him what's wrong?
He said, what's wrong?
Okay, we're going to send him to that location to see what's wrong with him, okay?
All right.
Police and fire, do you have an emergency?
There's someone stuck in his window. He's trying to break into someone's house.
What's the address, sir? Do you know the address of the house?
No, I don't. I'm calling from the house.
How are we going to find him?
I'm stuck in the window.
You're stuck in the window. In there.
I'm breaking in the house.
You're breaking into your own house?
No, I'm breaking in somewhere else.
911, what did... Oh. Whew. There is a disconnect somewhere. I mean, some of them, there's a disconnect because they have no idea what 911 is supposed to be used for. Some of them, though, the disconnect is they just can't connect common sense to their situation. But all of them are examples where something is just disconnected. And I don't know about you in your life, but in my life, I haven't called 911 very often. But I did about a year and a half ago. A year and a half ago, I was actually driving up to Lincoln, Illinois. We were presenting a book that had just been published in honor of my mentor, Dr. Robert Lowry. And so I was driving up there. It was going to be a really big day, a really cool moment. So I have all my stuff packed in the car, my suitcase, all my clothes, my pillows, because I'm weird and I always have to sleep on my pillows. And I also had my laptop in there so I could do some work. I also had 263 copies of this new book that we're going to be presenting to my mentor. So everything was packed, and all of a sudden I realized I forgot my sermon for that next Sunday, and I needed to go over it. So I was like, I have a little bit of time. So I raced to Ozark, and I printed off my sermon, and I raced right back home because I had to take my son Zion to school by 7:30. And so I finally get home. I pull into the driveway. I have two wheels inside my garage, two wheels on the driveway, and I bust out of the car, and I jump inside. I'm like, hey, Z, buddy, we got to go, man. We got to get you to school. It's like 7:25. Your mom will kill me if I get you there late. So, like, let's go. And I kiss my other kids goodbye. I say bye to my dad who was watching our kids, And I stepped outside, and I stopped dead in my tracks because my car wasn't there. And I raced down the stairs. I'm like, oh, no, what happened? And I looked down both sides of the street. I can't see it anyway. And all of a sudden, the words just fell out of my mouth. Someone stole my car. So I grab my phone. I start calling 911. And I'm like, in those moments, the adrenaline's pumping so much that you can barely put together a coherent sentence, more or less explain to them what's happening. Those poor 911 operators. So finally, I get the call, you know, reporting the fact my car has been stolen. I come inside, and I am visibly flustered. I am visibly agitated. And then something catches my attention. My son, Maddox, was walking down the hallway. He had his fist clenched. He's only 3 years old, mind you. Fist clenched, and he goes, man, that stupid guy. Can't believe he stole our car. If I find him, I'm going to punch him in the eyeball. And immediately all the adrenaline left me. And I got down, and I looked at my kids. I got all three of them there, and I said, hey, I said, we need to talk. I said, what's the most important thing? I said, we talk about this a lot in our family, but what is the most important thing? And Maddox goes, it's people. And I said, yeah, buddy, you're right. I said, so we're not going to be mad at this guy. I said, actually, we're going to be sad. Not because we lost something, but because this guy doesn't know Jesus. Because this guy doesn't have a community like we do, where if we need a car, we have 15 people that will offer us one. Or if we need money, we have people that will give us money. But this guy has no one. And so when he needs something, he has to steal from other people. We're not going to pray that he gets caught. We're going to pray that he finds Jesus. And so we bowed our heads. And we prayed. Why? I mean, that's pretty stupid for most standards of the world. My goodness, later that week, even when I was telling Christians that my car got stolen, I felt like I had to talk them off the ledge because they were wanting to stone the guy. And I was like, no, I get it. But honestly, we're overlooking something that is very important. We are overlooking something that is essential for us to understand. That if our theology doesn't impact how we live, then our theology is absolutely worthless. If our theology, what we think about God and what we know about Jesus and what we know about what he has called us to be as followers of Christ, if our theology doesn't impact how we live, every single moment, in every single situation, if it doesn't impact how we live, then it's absolutely worthless. It doesn't mean anything. If your theology only is something that you covet whenever things are good for you, if your theology is only something that you lean on whenever it gives you something, whenever you are the center of your theology, it is empty, it is worthless, it means absolutely nothing. And I don't care whether we're talking about you stealing or not stealing a ream of paper from work. I don't care if we're talking about you cheating on taxes. I don't care if we're talking about you desiring to divorce your spouse instead of reconciling. I don't care what the issue is. If your theology doesn't impact how you live, your theology is worthless. And that's exactly the issue Jesus is dealing with in Luke 10. The exact issue. Luke chapter 10, verse 25, it says this, on one occasion, an expert in the law, one of those professional theologians, an expert in the law comes to Jesus to test him. Teacher, he asked him, what must I do to inherit eternal life? And Jesus' response in verse 26, basically Jesus looking at him and saying, well, what does your theology say? I mean, that's what he says. He looks at me and says, well, what is written in the law? How do you read it? What does your theology say? And the man answers. He says, love the Lord your God with all of your whole heart and with all of your soul and with all of your strength and with all of your mind. And love your neighbor as yourself. Jesus responds. He says, you've answered correctly. If you do this, then you'll live. If you do what you just said, love your neighbors yourself, love the Lord, if you do this, you will live. And then in verse 29, the man asks a very interesting question, a very intriguing question. In verse 29, it says, but the man wanted to justify himself. So he asked Jesus, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? Now, on the surface, that may seem like a harmless question. Just a logical question. We said, love your neighbor as yourself. Okay, fine. Well, then, who is my neighbor? But whenever you start to look a little deeper into this question, you realize the man is asking something very different. When the man asks, who is my neighbor, what he's asking is, what are the limits of my love? Who do I have to love? And who do I not have to love? Because I know my theology says love my neighbor as myself. Love my neighbor in the exact same way that I love myself. I know it says that. But you surely can't be talking about the Roman centurion who's my neighbor. We hate him. So who is my neighbor? I mean, we surely can't talk about loving somebody that steals our car because we don't love them. That can't be our neighbor. So Jesus, please clarify this command for me. Who is my neighbor? You see, we learned something about the expert in the law on this question. Man, he gets the theology. He knows all the right answers to all the wrong questions. He knows theology. He knows the depths of God. He is actually trained to study the depths of these questions. He knows theology. But his question's looking for a loophole. His question is looking for a way out. His question is basically saying, who do I not have to love? If our theology doesn't impact how we live, then our theology is absolutely worthless. Jesus answers the man's question in verse 30. He starts to tell a story in verse 30. Jesus says this, a man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho. Now, the people in Jesus' audience would have known what road he was talking about because many of them probably have traveled that road even recently. Because whenever they go to a festival, they go to Jerusalem. And whenever they're going home, many of them not only would go to Jericho, but through Jericho. They knew this road very well. And they knew you did not travel this road alone. You always went in a group because this road was dangerous. So whenever Jesus continues the story, it doesn't shock his audience what happens. A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho when he fell into the hands of robbers. Oh, they stripped him of his clothes and they beat him and they went away leaving him half dead. And those in the crowd have been going, yeah, we know that road. And then Jesus gives them hope. Verse 31. A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he had pity on him. He went and bandaged him up. He poured oil on his head, and that is not what the text says at all. Is it? Is it? I'm sorry. No! That's what we would expect the text to say, because the priest has all the theology figured out. I mean, the priest gets it. But in this moment, where the priest knows the two greatest commandments, he knows the love your neighbor as yourself thing, he sees one of his fellow Jews that is inside of a ditch, and what does he do? A priest happened to be going down the same road, and when he saw the man, he passed by on the other side. Don't want to get mixed up with those people. He's probably already dead, and that would defile me. I mean, if I'm defiled, then a lot of people suffer from my apparent lack of theology. All right, well, fine. Maybe the priest was having a bad day. Verse 32. So a Levite came by the same road, and when he saw a man, he had pity on him. He bandaged him up. He put wine on his mouth and oil in his hair. And no, he didn't do any of those either, did he? Because the Levite doesn't act any different than the priest. In Jesus' story, it says this in verse 32, the Levite, when he came to the place and saw the man, he passed by on the other side. Two times in Jesus' story, the people that were supposed to be the ones that were not only leading the nation of Israel, not only leading the people of God, but those that God had given to be a blessing to the nations, two times, the people that were supposed to be the heroes are the villains. For they did not allow their theology, the second greatest commandment, to impact who they were. They denied it in lieu of personal holiness. But then the hero comes. Verse 33, the hero comes on the scene. Jesus introduces us to the hero in verse 33. But along the same road traveled a man who was a member of Al-Qaeda. I think I know how that made some of you feel. Because it makes me feel the same way. there's almost a tension. Because what goes through our mind is, no, the hero can't be from that group. There is no way that the hero is from that group. And I imagine that the expert in the law was feeling that same tension with Jesus when he said the word Samaritan. At that point, the expert in the law was trying to figure out whether or not he hated the messenger or the message the most. He couldn't figure out which one. Because in this story, the hero wasn't the priest. The hero wasn't the Levite. The hero wasn't the American Christian. In this story, the hero was one of his greatest enemies. For we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. The Jews and the Samaritans hated each other. I mean, the word hate even falls short of the way that these two groups felt towards each other. For they were not just in a war of words. They were not just in a war of theology. They took their war to the actual weapons of violence that some of us even still use today. They hated each other. The Jews wouldn't even walk on Samaritan soil because they thought it was tainted. Because the Jews looked at the Samaritans and said, you're half-breeds. You're lower than Gentiles. You're lower than the dogs. If it was up to the Jews, all the Samaritans would burn. If you don't believe me, ask James and John. The Jews hated the hero of Jesus' story. So much so that when Jesus asks a simple question in verse 36, the expert in the law can't even give the simple answer in verse 37. In verse 36, Jesus says, which of these three, the priest, the Levite, or the Samaritan, which of these three do you think was the neighbor to the man who fell into the hands of the robbers? Which of these three, expert in the law, was the hero? And the expert in the law could not even say the word. He couldn't even say the name. He couldn't say Samaritan. What does he say in verse 37? The one who had mercy on him. If our theology doesn't impact how we live, then our theology is absolutely worthless. It is absolutely worthless. Because this man asks the question, who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? What are the limits of my love? Who am I allowed not to love, Jesus? Who is my neighbor? And Jesus responds with the story that in essence asks a question. Jesus looks at the expert in the law and he says, do we get to choose who we love? Is that a choice that we get to make? In our theology, do we get to choose who our neighbor is? Jesus says, do we get to choose who we love? About a year ago, I was flying back from Colorado, speaking at a church out there, and I came in one Sunday night into the Springfield Airport, and it was like 11:30 or 12 at night. And I don't know if you've ever been in an airport that late, but man, when you're in an airport that late, everything is dead. I mean, the businesses are all closed down. Most of the lights are turned off. The hustle and bustle today is just not there. And that's why it surprised me whenever I came off of my plane and I saw a distinct commotion going on over in the corner. I mean, there must have been 40, 50, 60 people crowded over in this corner. And curiosity got the best of me, and so I sauntered over, and I noticed that all of them were looking up at a television screen. And I looked up, and I saw the caption. It said, Osama bin Laden killed. My first thought was, we got the sucker. We got him. And my second thought, and now he's burning in hell. I didn't know what to think. And I was confused. I didn't know what to feel. Because I knew the evil that this man did. I knew the terrible things that he did. I knew that he had killed innocent and unsuspecting people. I knew what he did. But do I get to choose who I love? Do I get to ask the question, who is my neighbor? And I know how that illustration makes many of us feel. I totally get it because it makes me feel the same way. I know how even having the hero of the story be Al-Qaeda makes some of us feel angry. And I imagine that's exactly the way the expert in the law felt with Jesus in Luke chapter 10. The exact same way. If our theology doesn't impact how we live, is it really worth anything at all? If our theology doesn't impact how we live, is it really worth anything at all? Because the problem is, it seems like that Jesus gives a very clear answer to the expert of the law. It seems like Jesus says, you don't get to choose who you love. You don't get to choose. I will choose for you. You see, I don't know about you, but in the center of my theology, in the center of what guides my behavior, in the center of everything that it means to be a follower of Christ, in the center of my theology stands a big cross upon which Jesus, while we were his enemies, died for us. Upon which, when Jesus is hanging there, his enemies are below him, and they're mocking him, and they're throwing insults at him. And yet, as Jesus hung in the midst of his enemies, he looks down and says, Father, forgive them. Forgive them. If our theology doesn't impact how we live, is it really worth anything at all? Another way of saying that is, do we get to choose who we love?
He sings praise to God for no seemingly apparent reason. Indeed, if anyone was to have issues with the Lord, it would be Mary Johnson.
For all you've done for me. He never had a chance.
In February 1993, Mary's son, Loramian Bird, was shot to death during an argument at a party. He was 20 and Mary's only child.
My son was gone.
The killer was a 16-year-old kid named O'Shea Israel.
I wanted justice. He was an animal. He deserved to be caged.
And he was. Tried as an adult and sentenced to 25 and a half years, O'Shea served 17 before being recently released. He now lives back in the old neighborhood, close to Mary. This. Close.
He lives next door.
Next door.
How a convicted murderer ended up living a door jam away from his victim's mother is a story not of horrible misfortune, as you might expect, but of remarkable mercy.
A few years ago, Mary asked if she could meet O'Shea here at Minnesota's Stillwater State Prison. As a devout Christian, she felt compelled to see if there was some way, if somehow, she could forgive her son's killer.
What'd she say to you? I believe the first thing she said was, look, you don't know me, I don't know you, let's just start with right now. And I was befuddled myself.
O'Shea says they met regularly after that. When he got out, she introduced him to her landlord, who, with Mary's blessing, invited O'Shea to move into the building. Today, they don't just live close, they are close. Clearly, Mary was able to forgive.
Unforgiveness is like cancer. It will eat you from the inside out. It's not about that other person. Me forgiving him does not diminish what he's done. Yes, he murdered my son, but the forgiveness is for me. It's for me.
For O'Shea, it hasn't been that easy.
I haven't totally forgiven myself yet. I'm learning how to forgive myself, and I'm still growing towards, you know, trying to forgive myself and what it is I've done.
To that end, O'Shea is now busy proving himself to himself. He works at a recycling plant by day and goes to college by night. He He says he's determined to pay back Mary's clemency by contributing to society. In fact, he's already working on it, singing the praises of God and forgiveness at prisons, churches, to large audiences everywhere.
Forgiveness is a powerful thing.
Which explains why Mary can sing her praise of thanks to her audience of one. Steve Hartman, CBS News, Minneapolis.
Do we get to choose who we love? I did not want to preach this sermon. Even whenever we outlined it 3 months ago, and even whenever I wrote it 6 weeks ago, with all that's in me, I did not want to preach this sermon. Because I know that even in this moment, some of you are trying to figure out which one you hate more, the messenger or the message. I get it. And that breaks my heart. Because I know some of you will leave here angry. I know that some maybe already have. Because this message bothers me too. Because this is a stupid love. This love makes no sense. And this love is scandalous in the highest regard. But if our theology doesn't impact how we live, then is it worth anything at all? I mean, it's not like that Luke chapter 10 is the only verse in the entire Bible that talks about this type of crazy love. It's not like it is the only verse in the entire Bible which God says, I want you to love everyone. For we could read Matthew chapter 5, verse 48, or 1 John 4, 19 through 21, or Matthew 27, 45, or Philippians 2, 1 through 11, or the whole chapter of 1 Corinthians 13. It's not like this is one isolated verse in the recesses of the books that we call God's Word. It's everywhere. I mean, it seems like Jesus' answer to the expert in the law is pretty clear. You don't get to choose who you love. Church, as a follower of Christ, you don't get to choose who you love. For Jesus looks at it and he says, your job is to live out your theology every single day, in every single situation, whether it is a good situation or bad. Your job is to love everyone, even if it kills you, kind of like it did me. I don't want my son Maddox to think that our theology is just a bunch of fun stories that we tell in Kids Country and Launchpad. I want him to know that our theology molds every moment of our lives, every decision that we make, everything. That our theology is not something we just talk about. Our theology compels us to actions of love. And if it doesn't, then it's just as bad as it's just a bunch of noise. It's just a resounding gong, just a clanging cymbal that means nothing. So here's the challenge. Who are your enemies? And how are you going to serve them? Who are the Samaritans in your life? And how are you going to love them with Christ's love? Sometimes Jesus' warnings just aren't easy. And if I could cut it out, I would. But I can't. For this is a command that doesn't come in the form of a law. This is a command that comes in the shape of a cross, which stands at the center of our theology.